So, Dr. Wright, you are the lead.
Yes, thank you. So, I understand the concern, the testimony around the mislabeling of a dog or a cat as a dog. That doesn't change the actual tests, though. It changes the reference ranges. So, the test results are still reliable and the same. That doesn't change anything there. And if you notice on the blood work, they don't want to disclose medical records to the public, but when it changes from dog to cat, you can see that the numbers stay the same, but the reference values change. So. That was something that happens. Whose fault is that? Hard to say, but that's a correction that doesn't change anything right there. That's just kind of a notation error. But the tests themselves were all valid. That doesn't change anything that way. Beyond that, I don't see any actual issues, violations based on statute. It sounds again like this is a communication issue, some grieving going on there, and kind of looking through and seeing things that aren't really changing anything in the medical record in there. I do see long hair, I see this, but I don't see anything medically that was done incorrectly, unless anybody else sees any issues. Yes?
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Of Dr. Wright. So the confusion between canine and feline would not have affected the diagnosis, by the way?
Not based on blood work alone, because the values themselves are still the same. It's still the same test. It's just in a cat, say, the kidney levels are going to be a little bit lower or a tighter range than in a dog. So the value itself is the same, but the reference range is what's normal is what's different.
Can you, as long as the veterinarian knew what the reference ranges for a cat were, and they evaluated what they got based on ranges for a cat, then it wouldn't affect anything.
So can you explain the part for the differential where there's a lab technician that's reading the blood smear whenever they put that note? Can you just explain why that note's on there and what the technician's seeing? Because I think that's a big confusion whenever you're reading a lab report that says, hey, the species doesn't match, call the reference lab, right? Why they put that note, I know, but could you explain it?
No, that's a good question. That's actually one of the things in vet school that we learn, is to identify a species off of blood smears. In many cases, not all cases, but there are certain characteristics we can see. For example, the eosinophil counts on cats is going to be significantly higher than most other animals. So you're going to see that and say, this doesn't look like a dog. And if it's a dog, that's a problem. So we're going to see some characteristic changes. You look at, say, an avian blood cell, you're going to see nucleated red blood cells. So you're going to know, okay, this is not a mammal. There's something weird going on here. So we can kind of pick up based on what the blood looks like in the microscope, what the actual individual cells look like, what species it comes from. Many times, not all the time.
Neutrophils are very different.
Yes, neutrophils.
Granules in a dog, and you can't see the granules in a cat. It's pretty obvious you're looking at a cat smear.
And the thing about submitting lab samples is it's not from your software. You go into their software, you click buttons for what your patient is. Right. Canine and feline are right next to each other, so that is something that it can get clicked one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And then when it submits, their job is to send you an alert if it doesn't look like it matches the species. Right. That way, if for some reason you had submitted a canine patient, but feline patient blood is there, their job is to let you know, because if a lab sample got mixed up, right?
Reference. Yeah.
But as a veterinarian, if you see your tech mark canine for a feline patient, you may not end up calling lab. You're just going to look at the reference ranges appropriately. Is that common?
Yeah, reference ranges are there as just a reference, but I mean, we can, as veterinarians especially, been doing it for a while, look at the actual numbers and say, okay, here's a problem, that's too high, that's too low. So the reference ranges are handy, and we do reference them for sure, but a lot of us know kind of what values are normal also, and we don't always look at those reference ranges because we don't need to.
Now, as far as the Miratas goes, because there is a reference to the side effects that are listed, my understanding is because this is an FDA-approved medication for felines, that the studies are done on felines, and that all of the patients that receive this drug or the placebo, all the side effects are listed by pet owners, and then therefore it goes into the insert.
Correct. During the actual approval process,
right.
You have to look at those kinds of things, and it can be hard to interpret what side effects actually are. That's why most medications have side effects that say vomiting and diarrhea, because if you're on a study for 6 months or whatever, what's the chance you're going to have a case of vomiting or a case of diarrhea in any given animal during that 6 month period? Well, you can wake up one morning and have diarrhea. That's just life. So there are certain things that can be really hard. It's also hard to interpret those inappetence ones when you're using an appetent drug, an appetent stimulant, because are we inappetent because of the drug, or are we inappetent because of the underlying disease that caused us to use the drug itself? So it gets really hard in those kinds of things. It is listed on the package insert on unknown complications.
Okay.
But was that at fault of a veterinarian? Is that actually a true thing, or is that a continuance of underlying disease? That's the hard part. Bless you.
Thank you. And then as far as the clerical errors go, I mean, I know personally I've never seen a veterinarian enter the patient information as far as if a pet is a long hair or a short hair. I know that's typically on, you know, a client care person or like somebody like myself, and I know I do make mistakes, but does that affect your standard of care when you have those types of things in there? From a veterinarian standpoint, are you concerned about that changing your care?
Not when it comes to coat length and that kind of thing. I mean, there are certain breeds that you're going to be looking at in specific diseases, but when it comes to coat length, it can be kind of a subjective thing, honestly. There's definitely jokes and theories out there, like, so there's only two breeds of cats, and domestic short hair, domestic long hair, and maybe a domestic medium hair. But there's definitely a lot of different breeds, but the coat length is not necessarily going to be a issue.
In terms of breed, if you're the veterinarian on the case, you're going to know the breed.
Yeah.
I mean, a domestic short hair and a domestic long hair is kind of a generic term for
this
breed,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not, it's if you knew the exact breed, you knew it was a Siamese, you would have put Siamese, right? So, like, I don't feel like that's not going to affect my clinical judgment. What I would say, and this is probably how the owner's looking at it, if I were guessing, is that this is just one example of the lack of attention to detail in the medical records and what else might have been missed. If things as easy as this were missed, what else might have been missed, right? And that's a very unfortunate thing for the clinic, because I can see how things like that happen, but there happen to be quite a few of them in this medical record, which is probably part of it. I don't think it changed the outcome. And while we're discussing it, I mean, I don't see anything in there that made me jump up and down, even on the blood work or anything that would have changed how I would have handled this case based on what we're talking about. And so if that helps with closure or anything else, that things, there wasn't anything that would have changed, I feel like maybe that helps, right? In knowing that, yeah, there were some inaccuracies, and yeah, the clinic should be paying more attention to that kind of stuff, and we shouldn't be making errors like submitting cats as dogs and dogs as cats, but that didn't change anything.
Yeah, it was corrected, and like I said, the actual test itself was run properly. It's just the reference ranges have changed. But I mean, the slides that were used, whatever testing modality they used at the actual laboratory, would have been the same between dogs and cats. So, no, I agree there. Based on discussion and based on everything I'm reading, I would make a motion to dismiss this with no violation.
Okay. Any other discussion? All those in favor, or is there a motion?
Excuse me.
A motion?
I'm the other half.
Oh, sorry, the time for comment is over. Thank you. Is there a motion? A second? Sorry.
I'd like to hear the motion. I couldn't hear it.
Oh, it was a dismiss with no violation.
And
if
a
nothing,
second?
They could do record keeping.
We can't have any comment at this time, sir.
Okay, so we have a first and a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Case 24-159, William Langhofer, DVM. Tracy, could you read the front load on that, please?
Absolutely. Case 24-159. The complainant is the Arizona Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The respondent is William Langhofer, DVM. On June 10th, 2024, the board office reviewed applicant Alex Wilson's veterinary application and noticed that he started an internship at the Scottsdale Veterinary Clinic in June 2023. Applicant Wilson's resume listed for June 2023 through July 2024. 14-month program consisting of emergency medicine, general practice medicine, and spay-neuter clinic. Performs spays, neuters, prolapse repair, dental extraction, dental cleaning, and anesthesia. presented clinical findings to colleagues, and wrote soaps and discharges. Executive Director Whitmore called applicant Wilson, who confirmed he was performing the services indicated on his resume, but had not been performing surgeries until after he passed the NAVLE. Veterinary medical services such as surgeries cannot be performed until an applicant becomes licensed in Arizona. According to respondent, applicant Wilson worked at the Scottsdale Veterinary Clinic as a veterinary assistant while a student and while waiting for his Arizona veterinary license. While working as a technician at the premises, it was possible that he was allowed to perform surgeries on strays or relinquished animals as part of their training program. Respondent stated that he did not present himself as a veterinarian, provide diagnoses, issue any prescriptions, or perform any surgeries on owned animals. And this case did not go in front of the investigative committee. It came directly to you for your review and consideration.
Thank you. The complaint is the Arizona Veterinary Medical Examining Board. Ms. Solomon, you are the lead on this.
Yes, I do have a couple of concerns.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Bill Langhoffer and David Soll appearing as legal counsel.
Thank you.
And Dr. Langhoffer, and Dr. Langhoffer has a statement to read.
Thank you.
Can I read it?
Yes.
Please.
And good morning. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you. As I indicated in my statement, I was the medical director and responsible veterinarian for the Scottsdale Veterinary Clinic. In that capacity, I oversaw a large hospital with over 20 doctors and over 120 staff members. Hospitals open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have a very extensive training program for our doctors and new staff members. The program includes a variety of lectures, mentor meetings, case rounds, cadaver labs, team building events, and wet labs where they do surgical procedures on cadavers. Alex Wilson is now a licensed veterinarian in Arizona. He doesn't currently work at Scottsdale Veterinary Clinic. After the internship, he needed some money, so he had to go somewhere else to work as a veterinarian. When he did work for us, he worked as a veterinary technician while he was a student, and during that time he never worked under my direct supervision, but did work under the direct supervision of other veterinarians in the hospital. To my knowledge, he never gave any diagnosis, issued any prescriptions, or performed surgeries on any owned animals. However, it certainly is possible he was allowed to perform surgeries on strays or relinquished animals, as that is part of our training program. These procedures are appropriate under ARS 32-2211, Part 4. Also, as I stated in my response, Alex never presented himself to the public as a licensed veterinarian. I confirmed that myself with Alex. He was never compensated as a doctor for any of the procedures that he performed in cadaver labs, on stray animals, and training classes, nor during any of the procedures that he may have assisted licensed veterinarians in performing. His compensation schedule were commensurate with a veterinary assistant, and he performed the duties of a veterinary assistant. I believe the complaint may have been generated because of certain statements that Alex made on his license application to things that he did as a technician in our practice while he was a student. Those statements may have created some confusion whether he is authorized to perform those services under the Arizona Practice Act. To prevent any confusion in the future, we've taken steps that I enumerated in my response to clarify the duties and responsibilities of a veterinary assistant who's awaiting their license to practice medicine as a veterinarian in the state of Arizona. Those steps now include a training memorandum, which I submitted, which clarifies the specific duties and responsibilities that any trainee may be allowed to perform. In closing, I am no longer the responsible veterinarian for the practice, as I'm managing a larger veterinary group. But during that time, and during the time Alex worked as a technician, he did not, to my knowledge, perform any services that were not allowed under the Veterinary Practice Act. I therefore request a complaint against me is dismissed with no violations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stoll, anything?
No.
Oh. Now your turn.
Huh?
Now your turn.
Now my turn.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I am curious as to whether this was past practice or a one-off, and I am concerned about it because unless there's some kind of formal teaching arrangement, I'm not sure that this is compliant. So I would make a motion to move it to informal for further information.
Question on your person as a past practice or?
Right, or was this a one-off? Was this just this one occasion with this one unlicensed graduate? Or was this past practice that they did this routinely?
Their training program or something specific, like the surgeries?
Yeah, it's performed veterinary duties, yes. By an unlicensed veterinarian.
So what would be the follow-through with that or the question for that?
I think you'd have to call in Dr. Wilson at that point, right? I think you'd have to call in Dr. Wilson for probably testimony at that point, right? To see kind of what was done or is that possible?
How do you want to explore that, I guess?
I'm more focused on the policies of the premise.
Right, but
what has been there?
All he can talk about is his tenure, right?
Right. So
if you have like some easy like questions, I'm guessing we could ask those now.
Those now? Okay.
Yeah.
How long were you the responsible veterinarian at that premise?
Since 2004.
Okay, so for quite a long time.
Okay.
And was this a one-off or a past practice?
What a one-off.
Pardon?
He wasn't practicing as a veterinarian. He wasn't representing himself to the public as a veterinarian. I guess I don't understand the question.
Okay. Because is your question, was he also there as a student before he graduated? Are you asking that?
Well, I think she's asking, is this something that's happened before?
Right.
Is this something that,
right.
why wasn't this caught and checked? Is that, I think, why she's asking.
Yes.
Because, I mean, a simple license check.
Yes.
Why don't you
show
ask that
stuff,
then.
So maybe that's
yes.
the question.
Why don't you ask that? Do you want to ask that?
Yes.
Yes.
I guess I don't understand, because he wasn't working as a veterinarian. He was working as a technician.
According to the statutes, performing surgery means you're working as a veterinarian.
Not on relinquished animals or cadavers, wet labs, that's appropriate.
My concern is that's normally done by shelters.
Well, I think I understand what you're asking, but I think your questions would only be answered by Dr. Wilson saying what were you allowed to do, but I don't know if Dr. Wilson can be called in under this kind of thing.
I think he would say, yes, I was doing a lot, because that's what was in the statement.
I think he would say, yes, I was doing them when
they were
shelter animals. Right?
Actually, I think that's where her questions would, if she asked questions, I think that's where they would go if you were going to go to that level. I just don't know how you would do that.
I think, James,
we've already dismissed that.
He's going to say, yes, I was doing that, is that still where you have your concern, because you have a non-licensed veterinarian who was doing surgery on relinquished or shelter animals?
Yes.
But we don't oversee.
We don't oversee shelter animals if they're being worked on by
shelter.
An employee of the shelter.
Right.
But
which
this
if Dr. Wilson was an employee, even as a technician, you're still an employee.
Right. This practice is not a shelter.
But it doesn't matter, it's employee.
If Ms. Solomon wants to ask Dr. Langhofer to address your concern, during his tenure as the responsible veterinarian, have they ever allowed technicians to perform surgeries on owned animals? That might address your concern.
I think we heard owned animals, though. What I'm understanding, so when you take in these animals that students are allowed to perform procedures on, are the whoever's bringing them in transferring ownership to the hospital?
In that case, if it's relinquished, it would, yeah.
So they would, and what if it was just a stray that you were going to release back out? Do you ever do those? Like a TNR kind of thing?
No, we would. And then we'd probably find a rescue to take it if it survived the surgery or whatever the situation was.
But it would be under
the hospital.
The hospital as the owner.
Right.
So this is where the does that make sense?
Like yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he wasn't presenting himself to clients as a doctor.
No, that was clear to me.
Okay.
My concern was about him. He did not represent himself as a doctor. However, it appears she was performing, so he states that he was performing certain surgeries. And the response was those were on stray or relinquished animals. So in those cases, the premise took ownership of the animal before it was performed. In that case,
In that case, he's allowed to do it.
Yes.
If the clinic had not taken ownership of those animals, even if they're strays or whatever, if it had been, if a shelter, so in a situation, if you work with a rescue and they brought in one of their animals to you to have it altered, would he have been doing the surgery on that animal?
Well, they would have to relinquish it in that scenario.
So that's where it gets a little bit tricky. If the rescue had kept ownership of that and you guys were just doing it for the rescue and letting him do it because it was a rescue pet, you're not the owner of it, he couldn't do that.
Right, correct.
But because if the process is, and what you're telling us is that all animals under that category are relinquished to the hospital and the hospital is the owner, then that he's allowed to do it.
Does the hospital relinquish ownership back to the same rescue then after the fact?
I don't know the specific situations, but in that sense, usually we don't ever relinquish back to whoever brought it because that's just a bad, you know, precedent to start. Yeah. So normally we find another rescue or someone else to take it in that scenario.
So it's not like a rescue comes in, we're going to take ownership of for 6 hours and do surgery and then give it back to you.
So it kind of sounds like we have more questions here than the top surface. So
yes. Well, I mean, I feel like I got the answer. What I would say is I would be very careful about that paperwork being very clear.
Now, Victoria, you had not talked to Dr. Langhofer. You had talked to the practice manager. So do you have anything that...
Right. I would just be cautious of saying that if they've taken ownership of the animal, that anybody could perform surgery because that could be considered animal cruelty.
Yeah.
I'm a layperson. If I worked for him, just because they own the animal doesn't mean that I could do surgery. So I would just, there's layers to your discussion that I just want to make sure everybody hears.
No, that's very true.
I mean,
cruelty laws.
Yes.
Yeah, cruelty laws override.
Right. This was somebody who already had
graduated.
Well, or at least had some training and was in a program to be trained to do this, and hopefully there's observation that's going on and instruction that's going on to support that.
I believe, Dr. Langhofer, you said it was under direct supervision?
Mm-hmm. Correct, yeah.
I don't have any further questions than any other board members.
And my only thing would be if a rescue does bring in animals for this, and they're not relinquishing ownership to the clinic, where you would then be giving it back to the rescue. It's a good rescue. Rescues do this all the time. But if you're not giving it back to that same rescue, you're not ever taking ownership, then those students cannot be performing those procedures.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
But we're not talking about students at this point. We're talking about graduates.
Graduate.
That have
an unlicensed
passed.
Graduate.
No one can be performing those at that point. Like, I guess I would say, if the ownership does not transfer to the clinic, then you can't have somebody.
So then there's no funds being transferred either. Like there's no money exchanging hands.
I don't
think that changes anything.
Yeah.
Well, it does, as far as
if it's owned or not. Because if you're paying money for
a rescue, you
still
be paying money.
The statute says regardless of compensation.
Right.
So, I guess the big thing is that it's just kind of the point is nailed home that students have more rights than
they go away when you're not
graduate. So you're kind of before vet school, you're done, you're just a layperson. You go into vet school, you have the rights under a student. As soon as you graduate, if you don't get a license, you're back down here again. You are just a regular layperson. And I think that's just the take home message there, is that those things are just known in the future.
Madam Chair, I move that we issue a letter of concern regarding advising the practice to make sure that animals that are with veterinary services performed on them under direct supervision by an unlicensed veterinarian, that those be relinquished animals to the clinic. Is there a better, neater way to say that?
Well,
no.
I think it is that a graduate that's not licensed can't perform veterinary services, period. Like that's.
I don't think there's a neater way to say that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I think based on testimony, that doesn't apply either. Because I understand your intent, but based on testimony from both sides, I don't think that there's, it sounds like things are, it sounds like the unlicensed thing is where we're kind of stuck on a hitch, but if the doctor wasn't performing medicine, then he wasn't practicing unlicensed, so there's no need for a letter of concern. I think the conversation that we have is more the concern at that point saying, hey, make sure all the ducks are in a row so that we don't have this kind of mistake in the future, potentially, verify licenses. It's a very easy thing to do.
Yeah, that's what I would be.
But I don't know if we can LOC.
I don't think, though, just because we're already tearing this apart into little pieces.
Right.
I don't think that the statute that refers to working on your employer's animals necessarily says any clause about student versus non-student. So students have different privileges under students, mm-hmm. but the statute that we're talking about with regards to who's working on the pet of that, because at shelters, technicians will do things.
Sure. Yeah.
Because those animals are owned by that shelter. So they can allow that to happen. That's the whole premise of this mid-level practitioner that we're getting into, which is they can go work in shelters as a mid-level practitioner today because they're not under the veterinary board. That would be the same thing here. If these animals are owned by the clinic, whether he was a student or not, they could still let him do that.
Yeah.
Victoria's point was, if they use bad judgment and let somebody do this that has no training and is not being observed, it's animal cruelty.
Yes.
That's not a vet board, but that's a different issue. Yes.
Yeah, it goes to the sheriff at that point. We have
right.
authority at that
but,
point.
But that's not because of student or no student.
Yeah,
under
that's
this statute.
Of that. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, no, so I understand what you're saying, because like I said, if this is something that's been a historical happenstance thing that we just haven't looked in since 2004, this has happened a few times here and there, whatever, that's one thing, but I think that's more of an assumption. I don't think you can make a letter of concern around that.
That wasn't clarified.
Yeah.
Whether it was a one-off or past practice.
Yeah, no, and I understand. And by the way, he said it's a one-off, and I understand what you're saying, but I don't know if we have enough information to rise to the level of an LOC, in my opinion.
Okay.
But I understand what you're saying. But I think, again, this conversation serves that point, too.
Okay. I hopefully you have taken in the conversation of the board. And with that, I will change my motion to a dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Okay, we have a first and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to roll back up to the top, but I believe that we do have a respondent for 24-127. Let's see. So AE Hershey DVM. Tracy, could you please read the front load on that one?
Yes. Case 24-127, the complainant is Winter Fenn. The respondent is AE Hershey DVM. On February 22nd, 2024, Amber, a 10-plus-year-old female Italian Greyhound mix, was presented to respondent's associate for evaluation of enlarged lymph nodes. Lymphoma was confirmed. Further diagnostics and chemotherapy treatment were recommended. On February 23rd, 2024, the dog was started on chemotherapy. On March 4th, 2024, respondent evaluated the dog and provided chemotherapy treatment. The dog was stable at that time. On March 11th, 2024, respondent evaluated the dog and performed diagnostics. Lab work revealed the dog was not responding to the current chemotherapy treatment. Respondent discussed her findings and recommended trying a different drug. Complainant approved. On March 15th, 2024, respondent evaluated the dog. The dog's appetite had decreased and lymph nodes were increasing in size. Treatment was provided based on lab results being in an acceptable range. The dog began declining, passing bloody diarrhea. Lymph nodes were increasing in size. Edema was present and the dog was labored breathing. The dog was seen at an emergency facility on March 17th, 2024, where treatment was provided. On March 21st, 2024, the dog was presented to an emergency facility due to labored breathing and the dog was humanely euthanized. Complainant expressed concerns with respondent's lack of communication and questioned the quality of care that was provided to the dog by respondent. And the committee concluded possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and it was agreed and seconded that the board find ARS 3222-312 as it relates to Article 11-5011, failure to provide courteous verbal or written interchange and considerate treatment to the pet owner surrounding the care and treatment of her dog. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Thank you. So we do have Dr. Hershey and Mr. Stuhl.
Correct.
If you could please state your name for the record.
Dr. Elizabeth Hershey.
And David Stuhl, appearing as Dr. Hershey's attorney.
And then if you have a statement.
I do. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to respond to the investigative committee's recommendation. Anyone who knows me or has worked with me or referred patients to me knows me to be a very dedicated, professional, compassionate veterinarian who goes above and beyond for clients and their pets. I often come in on weekends to finish paperwork, sign sympathy cards, respond to emails, and make clay pots. I had scheduled time on a weekend to respond to Ms. Venn's email as I wanted to have a quiet environment in which to write a thoughtful response. The response took me considerable time to compose, which is not something that can be done during the course of a busy day treating patients, and why the response was sent 6 days after the initial email was received. Because we have a very busy patient schedule and try to help as many patients as possible, most communication with clients outside of scheduled appointment times is done by email. Email communication has been instrumental in providing results to owners, including biopsies and blood work, as timely as possible. I believe email communication to be not only an acceptable, but also an excellent means of communication with clients. It is more efficient. It serves as a written documentation of the information discussed with the client, which is then part of the medical record and can be shared with the referring veterinarian. The owner can respond to the email with additional questions. Estimates for further diagnostic testing and treatment can be shared with the client, and appointments made to start treatment. The vast majority of owners appreciate this method of communication as it allows for repeated dialogue at a time convenient to the owner. I have quality of life discussions with owners via email and discuss euthanasia and end of life care. Owners have been appreciative of the time I take to thoughtfully respond to their concerns and questions by email. Client communication through a client portal, similar to email, has become the standard of care in human medicine to communicate with medical staff. We respond to emails Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Our email response tagline clearly states when the email is monitored. Our email response also clearly indicates that urgent emails will be replied to the same day during the hours of 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Non-urgent email communication will be reviewed and responded to within 2 to 4 business days, barring vacation and holiday exceptions. Examples of non-urgent emails are those requesting refills of medications the pet has been on, requests for change of appointment time and or evaluation of supplements the owner would like to try for their pet. Urgent emails regarding medication for a side effect of treatment or concerns about the patient's condition are answered in the same day as stated above. Outside of these hours, the email states to contact the regular veterinarian or go to the nearest emergency clinic. I am able to access the clinic email from my iPhone and do occasionally survey the client emails for clients with more urgent concerns and do occasionally reply from my iPhone. Much of the time that I reply from my iPhone is when I am not in the clinic, including the morning when Ms. Venn emailed at 7:03 a.m. to indicate that Amber was having difficulty breathing. She emailed several more times, the last email indicating that she was on her way to the emergency clinic with Amber. I responded to her email to let her know that Amber was in the end stages of lymphoma and tried to comfort her by telling her that she had done everything possible for her and that it was time to consider euthanasia. Again, I was being compassionate in my intent to comfort her by letting her know she had done everything possible so she would have the peace of mind to make the decision on euthanasia. This exchange happened before 8 a.m. when the clinic is officially open. I was scheduled to be in my office later that morning after 10 a.m. due to my own personal doctor's appointment. Had Amber had difficulty during our normal office hours, I would have offered to see her myself or called her personally. I believe this to be a situation where Ms. Venn simply did not like our method or style of communication, which is a matter of personal preference. We communicated with her on multiple occasions, verbalized on more than one occasion that her dog's cancer was progressing despite treatment, and assured her that she had done everything possible. We communicated with Ms. Venn the same way we communicate with all our clients and have an exceptional reputation for the care of our clients and patients. I do not believe I did anything wrong in the style or manner in which I communicated with Ms. Venn. This case is not even about the medical care of Amber, which the investigative committee found no fault. I do not believe the veterinary board wants to set a precedent in dictating the manner in which a veterinarian and their staff is able to communicate with clients. The operative words in ARS 3222-3212, as it relates to AAC R311501, is courteous, verbal, or written interchange and considerate treatment. I think I was well within a reasonable definition of those terms. My intent was to comfort an owner who was likely losing her pet at that moment, that she had done everything she could and she was making the best choice for her dog with euthanasia. In my opinion, that is a completely reasonable interpretation of both courteous and considerate. In closing, I want you to know that throughout my course of my 28 years of practice, I have always sought to improve myself. That is true with respect to my response to this complaint. Although not obligated to do so, I recently completed the following 4 hours of continuing education in the area of client communication through the VetMed Teams communication course. A 1 hour course entitled Beyond De-escalation, Connecting with Calmness on August 20th, 2024. A 1 hour course entitled Master the Money Conversation, Move Your Clients to Yes on August 20th, 2024. A 1 hour course entitled Powerful Client Communications Through Social Media on August 22nd, 2024. And a 1 hour course entitled Betsy on Demand on How to Handle Negative Online Reviews on August 24th, 2024. I'm also doing another communication course, which I have not yet completed, through the same VetMed Teams. I hope you will recognize these efforts and the fact that I was courteous and professional in my communications with the owner in this case. Thank you.
Oh, just on a personal note, I've worked with Dr. Hershey over the years, and I know her to be an extremely dedicated and courteous professional veterinarian who, as an oncology veterinarian, unfortunately has to be the bearer of bad news, and I think that plays into this unfortunate case. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Dr. James, you are the lead.
No, we don't have any complaint.
No.
I mean, I think there's a lot of factors going on here that make this case hard to interpret. And as I started reading it, I was like, okay, I saw where the investigative committee was going and that they felt like we have this client and we have this vet that needs a lot and is going through chemo and we've never met the doctor and we've had one phone conversation in the course of this period of time. Is that really adequate communication? As I started looking at it from things are advancing and how we used to practice medicine and everything being face to face and on phone is not how it is anymore. And telemed is a big thing and it is going to become a big thing and communication is not going to be the way we thought it had to be before. And I agree that we can't dictate how people communicate. That's a style. Like there's reasons why people don't like me as their veterinarian. That's okay. Like that's just a style. And so I feel like when you look at the level of communication, it was adequate and thoughtful. I mean, I think there was that there too. I think the other piece of this, and maybe I would be wrong here, but I don't believe Dr. Hershey saw this client on the initial visit, that this was done by a relief veterinarian who initially saw this dog. So at the time where the owner would have made a face-to-face and been able to put a connection there, it didn't happen because we were using a relief vet. That's normal, but that may have played into why this owner felt like they had no connection to the veterinarian who was now taking over the case. It's not wrong, it's just I think that that's the other factor here. I didn't actually have a problem with the communication that was in there. I think we want things more timely, and yes, we want answers more timely, but that's not always reasonable. I mean, it just isn't. Not in the state of the profession where we're as short as we are. I just think, you know, this owner did the right thing, and the times where it was urgent, she went to the emergency clinic, right? And she should have, and she did the right thing. I just don't think that the communication issue rises to a level of concern.
No, I agree, and you're right, things are changing, and for many years we've been pushing ourselves to be more like human medicine, and to be honest, I mean, I see my doctor maybe once a year for 5 minutes. Everything else is nurses and reception staff and relaying information that way. With how busy veterinary hospitals have been lately, we're going towards that. I mean, we have to be more efficient in communication. The statute does not say anything about it has to be this way, it has to be that way. It says courteous. I mean, courteous is polite. You're not dropping swear words and that kind of stuff. Or, I mean, you just got to be courteous to the people. I don't think that verbal or written communication by default is not courteous. I don't like that. So I disagree with the finding of the committee also.
And if you don't like the style, like what Dr. Mm-hmm. Jane said, pick another doctor.
Yeah.
Like, because if you want somebody to sit face-to-face with you, as mm-hmm. opposed to email you or call you back or, you know, whatever, then pick that doctor. But, you know, if this works for the vast majority of her clients and that's how her practice is, then there's nothing wrong with that. So I agree with not dictating style of communication.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. The owner was not happy with the style, and I get it. They wanted face-to-face time. I don't love all the changes in our profession either. Like, some of them are making things harder, and it isn't as connected to owners as we once were, and you don't necessarily have that. And it's kind of sad. But it's also kind of like it's the end of an era, and it's not wrong. It is part of the world we live in.
And I think sometimes the written word comes across as less compassionate than the spoken word. And so,
I don't know. You've read a good book. You might disagree.
But you read those text messages around there.
Veterinarians are never as good. Sorry, and you can't forget it. That's the thing that I appreciate in written. Is that you can't say the doctor didn't tell me this, so I understand that style because it is written forever and memorialized.
Yes.
Now it can't be, the doctor didn't tell me that.
Right.
Well, the doctor's like, oh my gosh, I just spent an hour talking to them.
Right.
They remember 5% of what I just said.
No, I agree that it's the most efficient way to transmit information, not necessarily the most efficient way to transmit.
I disagree efficient because it takes a lot of time and thought to sit down and write something.
It does, but I understand what Ms. Solomon's saying because, like I said, people get themselves in trouble on text messages all the time, emails.
Yeah, well,
I mean, we know this, especially when email was a new thing.
Yes.
Because I'm old. People were just sending off emails and it's like, oh, are you yelling at me? What's going on? Why are these capitals?
Yes.
We're in that kind of transition period of, is email by default non-personal? And no, it's just another form of communication. So I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you, because you can read a text message or something from someone and interpret it completely different because the inflection is not there.
Even emails, yes.
Yeah,
so. Bottom line, I have no problem with dismissing the violation.
All right, so I will make a motion in the case of 24-127 that we find no violations of our practice act or rules.
Second.
I have a motion. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Anderson. And then, let's see. Just being conscious of time because Dr. Byrne, we're calling him 10:30?
At 10:30.
Okay. All right. So we do have. Number 10, 24-129. We do have the respondent here, so we'll. Tracy, would you read this front load on 24-129 regarding Tony Barnes DVM?
Yes. Case 24-129, the complainant is Claire Johnson, the respondent is Tony Barnes DVM. On November 29th, 2021, Zach, a 14-year-old male, large mixed breed dog was presented to respondent for evaluation due to weakness in the hind limbs and intermittent abdominal bloating. After evaluation and abdominal radiographs, respondent suspected the dog had a splenic mass and recommended surgery. On December 8, 2021, the dog was presented to respondent's associate to have the abdomen explored. Surgery was performed and revealed a negative explore. A mass was not found in the dog's abdomen. Complainant expressed concerns that the dog underwent unnecessary surgery and never returned to normal afterwards. And the committee concluded that possible violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred. It was moved and recommended that the board find ARS 3220-3212 as it relates to R3115041, failure to provide current professional and scientific knowledge for not offering further diagnostics or second opinion prior to recommending surgery. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Okay, so we do have Dr. Burns. Good morning. Could you please state your name for the record?
Tony Barnes.
Thank you. And then do you have a statement?
I do. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to respond to the investigative committee recommendations. First of all, I would like to extend my sincere sympathies to the Johnson family for the distress they suffered from Zach having a difficult last year of his long life. The end of a beloved pet's life is always difficult in any situation. I was the veterinarian that examined him on 11/29/21. Given history of his abdomen periodically bloating and then going down and then bloating again, I was suspicious of something going on inside of the abdomen. On the initial exam, I did feel a mass in the cranial abdomen. I recommended blood work and x-rays. The chemistry panel was overall unremarkable except for an ALP of 318, which didn't concern me given the fact that he was a 13-year-old Labrador retriever with arthritis. I was not concerned over that mild increase in the CBC was unremarkable. VD radiograph showed lack of detail in the cranial abdomen and mid-abdomen with no clear splenic margins. The intestines were pushed cranial into the right and caudal to the left. The lateral radiograph showed a large spleen with some displacement in the intestines. Based on the history, the exam, and the suspicious nature of the radiographs, I recommended an exploratory surgery. I was unable to perform the surgery that evening because of a commitment to do a shift at the emergency clinic, and Zach was stable, so I recommended another veterinarian in the practice do surgery as she had an opening in the near future. Dr. Maltese, not Dr. Cease, performed the surgery. Had I been the veterinarian who performed the surgery at a later date, I would have re-examined Zach, I would have reviewed the blood work and the radiographs, I would have recommended an ultrasound to determine if there was, characterize the mass and assess the abdomen. Had I continued with an exploratory and it was negative, I would have recommended them biopsies to at least see if we could get an answer as to why he was intermittently bloating. At the time of this occurrence, the practice did not send out radiographs for review.
Thank you. No complaint, correct?
Correct.
Oh, you can go ahead and step back, Dr. Lance.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Wright, you're
yes.
the lead on the case.
And thank you very much. Again, this is kind of one of those where I would like a lot of discussions. I hate to kind of push everybody out or things out to everybody else, but the question here is, like I said, one, the interpretation of the x-rays, which can be a little bit difficult to interpret. I mean, there's definitely some loss of detail in there. Is that technique? Is that something else going on? It's hard to say there that way, but there's definitely some concern around there. But where do we go from there? And is abdominal exploratory surgery a wrong diagnostic step? And that's where it's kind of a little bit hard for me. Yes, we have different modalities. We could do MRIs, we could do CTs, we could do ultrasounds. But I mean, honestly, when I was in school, the gold standard was an abdominal exploratory if you have a concern of something going on in there. It is a diagnostic test that is a viable one. It's invasive, but it is the best way to see truly what's going on. Now, is that jump too fast? I guess that's kind of the question, but it's hard for me to say that a negative exploratory is some kind of violation. That's a real difficult thing for me to wrap my head around, because negative exploratories, we're not finding a negative exploratory, which I hate calling that. I say it's a chance for biopsies. But if you're not finding that, the kind of rule is you're not doing enough exploratories.
I was going to say, yeah. Does anyone else talk because, that if you don't have negative yes. exploratories, you're not doing enough yeah. of them?
Because if you've missed it and you didn't do it, you'd be here for the reason that you didn't do
yeah.
it.
I mean, I think there are other modalities that we have now that we didn't have when I went to school that worked, that could have been done. What I would say is some of those are not always options, whether it's because they don't have an ultrasound in clinic or they don't have, the owner doesn't have the finances to do those things. Like sometimes you're still going to make the decision to go straight to an exploratory because it's going to cut to the chase and you're going to find out, right? Like I mean, sometimes I can see where that would happen. I don't necessarily know that I would say that was wrong. I would hope that other options were communicated to the owner on what other things could have been done before you go to an exploratory. But just going to an exploratory doesn't give me.
No. And I've had this conversation. Of course, it's hard to say that kind of conversation happened here, but you can have an ultrasound that's going to cost $800, $900 to do, potentially even a little more, whereas you could apply that money towards. When I used to do surgery a few years ago, it was a lot less than it is now, but I mean, that was a significant portion of the surgery. So do you do an ultrasound or some other advanced testing that's gonna cost a lot of money?
You
or do
at
you
least recommend it.
Yeah, say it's the discussion.
The finances is shouldn't be an issue
at
this point.
But that's the conversation I have is, do we do that test and then also have to go to surgery, or do we go straight in, it's more invasive or what? But yeah, again, I'm having a hard time with an actual violation here.
And I would say too, sometimes it's hard. I mean, I have a group of veterinarians that I chat with on a regular basis, mostly via text. And it was funny because somebody just like a couple days ago was like, hey, my normal sonographer is not available. They cannot get me in. I don't know who to send this client to. Like, where do I get this
done? Did that happen
and
here?
No, I'm not saying it happened here, but what I'm saying is that like there's a lot of different reasons why you might make a decision that wasn't here. And that's why I'm saying I would hope that other options were talked with, to talk to the owner about other options before you went to Explore. But at the end of the day, the exploratory is not what's giving me the grief. But you know what I mean? It's more of the communication and the working up of the case and giving an owner options than.
And that, yeah, that's a concern. I think Dr. Nozick has something to say too.
Well, first of all, this patient was not an ill pet exam. This was a routine annual checkup with a rabies vaccination. The radiographs have been looked at by a lot of veterinarians here, and nobody's going nuts mass. Only possible splenomegaly. Surgical intervention of a patient at this point who was very stable and was not an ill pet and had normal lab work. So it seemed to be based on not completely visualizing splenic margins. So that's this decision that was made to do surgery. The radiographs were not submitted. There was another doctor in the practice who wasn't asked to look at the radiographs. Other diagnostics are very, very important in a case like this. This is not an emergency situation.
I agree with that, and that's why I'm saying like they should have offered other things.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the standard of care says you have to send out an X-ray.
Well, and the question there is...
Well, it wasn't an emergency because it was done how many days later? A week and a half or something
almost
later?
10 days.
It was scheduled like a while afterwards. I was trying to navigate.
Yeah, the 29th and 8th.
Yeah, so you're 8 days.
And I guess the question there is that the responsibility of the initial doctor or of the doctor that performed surgery?
Good.
I guess that's kind of the question.
Very good question.
Yeah, do you go in blind on that? I feel like if you're the doctor taking a case, you're going to...
As a rule, I never do anymore because I've run into situations like this too.
And the investigative committee has that discussion.
Oh, wait.
I'm sorry.
Did she run?
She was answering the phone.
Oh.
So I think you just need to pause until she gets back.
We're not quorum.
Should we take a
2-minute
break?
Jack,
take a break?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We're just going to pause for a minute here,
yeah.
Dr.
We
Barnes.
Don't have a quorum.
Because we don't have quorum when Dr. Jane stepped out. So give us just a couple minutes here. Take a bathroom break.